got your list, Andrew. So I'm good to go.
Oh, I mean, I just that was just off the cuff. So wherever you guys take things, there's no shortage of topics, I think. But happy to be here talking with you.
I have a couple of questions that are kind of into the weeds, and so I don't know if we want to jump in that way, but I hope we get to them at a certain stage.
Sure. Yeah, whatever works, guys. I'm flexible. Try to be.
Okay, Jared, do you want to get us started or tell us what to do?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, it's set up. We kind of are recording by default, so there's no real necessity to do a kind of formal start, and well, we can just start hanging out and chit-chatting. So, yeah, Andrew, is there anything that you'd be most excited to start with? Some more general stuff, or some, yeah, right into the meat of some of the astro and axiology
Oh,
and yeah.
yeah. I mean, I think it's helpful to contextualize things personally a bit. If we want to start there, we can. I'm always interested in people's personal narratives, how they find their way into
Yeah.
certain material, and the sort of How I Found God book series stuff that I'm doing is playing on the importance of telling those narratives. So that's one way to begin. But yeah, really, we can jump into the astro, exo, ultimacy. The intro I'm writing on Whitehead, which is I'm having a lot of fun doing, but it's a challenge. And so yeah, whatever works.
Yeah, let's start with that the personal side of things. I think that could be a nice way to get into it, and that's certainly an element we are trying to foreground in all these podcast conversations. So, yeah, how'd you get into the process stuff, spirituality,
Sure.
religion, more general? What's the arc of your life look like? And where's
It's
it
still
going?
arcing.
Where's the telos here?
The telos. I'm quite sure there is a telos of some kind, but it may not be going somewhere in particular, right? This is where Teilhardians and Whiteheadians will disagree. No, well, I was raised in a Protestant evangelical community, and it's certainly on my mom's side. So I went to all Protestant Christian schools from elementary school all the way through high school, and loved it for the most part. You take your initial context for granted. The classes that I enjoyed most were usually my Bible classes, which is partly because the instructor I had was quite good in the sense that he'd leave open questions rather than close them down. And I love that because it gave me a sense of having something to contribute to an open question that may not have a perfectly settled answer. When I think back, those were early indications of a certain trajectory that I would follow with respect to this material. And I remember meeting with friends on Rocky Point up on a hill, and the stars just beautiful, just poking at the stars. I just loved to do that since I was young, and that's always sort of stayed with me. So I love Whitehead's statement at the end of Modes of Thought, that philosophy begins in wonder, and in the end the wonder remains. Of course, he's taking that from Plato and the early Greek thinkers, of course, but I've had that sort of wonder with me. And it was just a natural progression from, for whatever reason, given my background, that it would find its way into the new avenues of philosophical and theological interest. So part of my philosophical journey is wrestling out a lot of the questions that you have as a conservative evangelical kid, the problem of evil being one. And so at Point Loma in San Diego, where I did my BA in philosophy and theology, initially was biblical studies, quite interested in that. Reading more got me more into theological questions proper, and certainly a little bit of philosophy. But it really wouldn't be, I think, until master's work at Claremont School of Theology. It was Claremont Lincoln at the time. It was this new interreligious university. There was a lot of possibility and excitement associated with it. It didn't last very long, but I did a master's work in interreligious studies, and the world opening up to me. I had been traveling at the time too, so my experience was bringing me new questions. But it was the first, I think, semester of my master's work at Claremont where I took a Ministry in the Problem of Evil class. And Jay, you remember John Sweeney, I'm sure. John Sweeney was then working at the Center for Process Studies, but would teach occasionally a course on the problem of evil. And so it's that course where I first began to read some of the options that process thinking allows. So Cobb, Griffin, Hartshorne, Whitehead. And my sort of mind just expanded with respect to what's possible to affirm philosophically and theologically. And if it wasn't for that course, I think, yeah, I'm not sure where I'd be, but that sort of lit a fire under me. I started reading voraciously in Whitehead and deepening myself metaphysically. So Whitehead helped me become a metaphysician in a way that I didn't know was possible. And I've just been following that sort of process ever since. And the arc is still arcing, to bring it back to that comment. I mean, so that's a little historical personal contextualization.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of people in our community, especially on the open and relational side of things, who came out of this evangelical context, and to varying degrees are still in it, have a new relationship with it, are part of some new form of perhaps post-evangelicalism, but maybe still connected in certain ways. Tom Orr, Trip Fuller, two major friends of ours, I think of right off the bat. And certainly they have quite the influence. I get a somewhat different vibe from you, Andrew. When I think of these folks who came up from this evangelical context, those are the folks I think of first, more so than yourself. So it seems like you have some kind of different relationship with this part of your identity and are perhaps carrying it forward in a different way. So this was somewhat of a nebulous vibes-based question, but yeah, do you feel a difference in temperament or concern from some of our other raised evangelical friends? If so, what do you think is the source of that?
No, I think that's a really good question. Yeah, the vibes, right? You're apprehending a certain dimension of me. It's not that I'm wholly detached from that world. Still, I still have a lot of great friends that are working both in committed ways to the evangelical world and less than committed ways, or maybe committed ways to the post-evangelical world. It's just that my main interest and focus sort of moved away from the need or desire to have the evangelical audience be my own. You know, it's great that they, if they want to be, and I would love to write an introduction to process theology, which would try to lay out in my own creative way what that vision might look like. But it's just that, and I can appreciate the deconstructing phase. It's very important. I went through it myself, but partly I get fatigued with it because I feel like there's a tendency to be stuck in the phases of deconstruction. Whereas I want to recognize them, like it's like Richard Kearney says, this anatheistic movement. I like that term, right? This prefix "ana" meaning a returning to or rediscovery of God, and what that arc looks like, to use the arc language, is phases of doubt, disbelief, and atheism. But the journey still moves past those things. Now, people are in the phases of deconstruction, doubt, disbelief for decades. They certainly can be. I wasn't for whatever reason. And I think Whitehead and process thinking helped me with that. But part of what got me out of remaining in somewhat angry phase of deconstruction was seeing that there were philosophical questions that I needed to ask, metaphysical questions that I didn't even know I initially had, and that Whitehead's thinking helped with that. So I'm interested in philosophical counseling, theological counseling, and most of those I talk to would be from the evangelical world. But I have a respect, I think, for my evangelical background. I think there's a certain tendency to it's not to see that background as valueless, but to remain in a certain state of anger about it. And I don't know if I really have that. I taught for 2 years at my after my master's at Claremont, at my evangelical high school. 7th through 12th grade teaching Bible classes. And of course, I wasn't, you know, teaching as an evangelical person, but you can do a lot of creative things within a certain context that is the evangelical world. So that's nothing against Tripp, nothing against Tom, certainly. They're brilliant communicators. Open relational world is great. It's a more palatable expression of certain key intuitions that I think process thinkers give that flesh out more robustly in a metaphysical sense. Do you think that's fair? I mean, there's differences between them, right? Process thinkers seem more metaphysically committed, as it were, than certain dimensions of the ORT world.
Yeah, that would be my sense of things too. And in some ways the process tradition is a little more I mean, there are multiple expressions of it in different faith lineages already.
Sure.
And I mean, I think the open and relational folks certainly aspire to that as well. But when I engage with their discourses, it feels like I'm stepping very much into often a post-evangelical type of context, which for me is very unfamiliar. That is not a history I have personally.
Yeah, sure. Well, and let me just add to that. I think what must happen, I think, Jay, you're brilliant at this, is in order for process thinking to have an impact beyond the ivory tower of the academy. And we were just at Harvard, Randy Auxier saying, he won't even let people write dissertations on Whitehead because it's just going to get them nowhere, as it were. I disagree. But that the audience that's going to take and run with these insights is much broader than just the academy. And so we need to find a way, struggle to find a way to express these insights creatively and in language that can be digested. Jay, what you're doing on Open Horizons is a great example of that. I'm trying to do that in part with my Whitehead book that I'm currently writing. But it is a challenge and it's a need, I admit.
Andrew, let me tell you one place where I still hear the evangelicalism in
Yeah,
you.
sure.
One trait of a lot of Christian thinking, but that includes evangelical Protestant thinking, is a preoccupation with ethics. Where the kind of consuming question, one consuming question is God, and another is goodness.
Yeah.
How can I be good? What happens when I'm not good? What is goodness? And there's an element of Whitehead, as you know, that is interested in beauty. And to really be in awe of some forms of beauty, you have to leave behind questions of goodness. Aspects of the natural world, for example, flare forth in non-moral ways, but they're still awesome. You can hear forms of music that are abrasive and not necessarily conducive to anything you'd call goodness of the soul. I'm thinking of forms of doom metal music, for example. Sludge metal happens to be in my mind right now.
Careful.
But nonetheless, they're intense. And there's something attractive about that intensity. So I guess I started that as something I hear in you, but you've been very interested in ideals and the role of ideals in human life, how when we're drawn to values understood as ideals, is that of which goodness would be one, but beauty another, and truth still another. Do you
Sure.
think the concern with ideals reflects your evangelical heritage? I guess that's my first question. And the second is, where does beauty fit in for you?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You have me thinking now of Evangelion, right? The good news, right? Which evangelical should be espousing. But my initial gut reaction to whether or not that's an expression of the evangelical dimension within me is probably no. I may be wrong about that, but I wasn't always preoccupied, or at least clearly preoccupied, with the status of value, the
Oh,
status of
really?
goodness, beauty, and values. Well, and it's not that I wasn't, right? Because the Christian, Judeo-Christian backdrop, right? In part, the universe is seen to be good, right? There's already this primordial acknowledgement of a sense of certain worth attached to creation already in Genesis. Of course, I knew about that, but I think the philosophical impact of value wasn't really understood by myself until, deeper in grad school and wrestling partly with Whitehead, because certainly, and I think McGilchrist here recently, and Max Shaler's work, the German phenomenologist, because there is a certain proclamation that value, I think, that I came to see value as involved with, right? It's announced to us in a certain way. So the idea that we enter a sort of axiological tabula rasa eventually became very absurd to me, like as if we're the sole creators of what reality is rather than an expression of it. And Whitehead really helped me say that. Beauty is a wonderful place to begin, and or aesthetic intensity, say. And it is where Whitehead begins. There's one statement he has where he's essentially responding, I think it's modes of thought, to this question of where it is that philosophy should begin. He says, well, it could begin more rationally with mathematics, more theologically, with questions of God. But what I recommend is we look to the aesthetic dimensions, because for him, at least, they were so sufficiently obvious in a human experience that they have to be dealt with, like the vulgarities we see in moral failures, ethical failures. Now, you asked the question about beauty and goodness. That's a tangled relationship we haven't quite figured out yet. But I certainly agree that when it comes to the arc of the emergence of values over evolution, I think aesthetic value is fundamental in the emergence of value in our human experience. I don't think that makes goodness less fundamental. After all, if we're going to theologize it, Whitehead says part of God being the poet of the world is this goad towards the ideals of truth, beauty, and goodness. So I became rather interested in why the universe exists. This is a fundamental metaphysical question. I read John Wesley, partly through Roland Faber's advice. And this question of value being or an axiological reason for things, even for a process, right? Whitehead, even in his Harvard lecture, talks about the becomingness of values, like something of greatness is being achieved in the process. If you don't have value, you can't say that, you know? And it's not as if nothing's going on. Something's going on. And that something has a certain qualitative character, at least possibility associated with it. So I don't really like to subordinate the transcendentals to each other. And maybe you disagree and put value at the top, but I just think they have to be seen like a prism through each other. And it becomes hard to isolate them because certainly some moral actions are beautiful. Some beauty we can't help but say is also good. And so I think Whitehead tangles those together in a way that make it difficult for me to have a certain hierarchy involved. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah, I think my question wasn't all that good, but I think your answer was fantastic. What I think if I could repose my question, I don't want to dwell on this too long. But it's been my experience that the evangelical Christian traditions are good on goodness, but not as able to deal with beauty. Understood as the aesthetic dimension of life, sometimes which does not require preoccupations with moral goodness.
Sure.
It's just
That
beautiful. But I think I'll ask you, does that impression fit your own experience or by contrast not?
I think it does. Framed in the way you did, I would agree with that. Yeah. So the preoccupation with ethics and morals to the negligence, say, of the more erotic, as it were, aesthetic dimensions. I agree, certainly.
But I think your work strikes a better balance, in my view. I think it
Well,
seems to
thanks.
me
Yeah,
when I
I
read
tried to.
what you write, you are sensitive to both of those entangled values.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with values. It's a tablecloth upon which you have a bunch of dishes. And if you try to grab one value and lift it, you just can't. You grab a tablecloth, everything comes with it. I think this is a sort of metaphysical insight to the fact that all values are entangled, even greater and lesser values, positive and negative values. The philosopher has a problem the moment he's insisted upon a real value, the achievement of a real value. And yeah, it's become really central for me. And I think Whitehead's been an important influence in that regard. Not just Whitehead, but obviously Whitehead has had the most influence on my thinking philosophically. So.
Okay. Jared,
Yeah,
back to you.
should we turn there now? You're writing an intro to Whitehead. There's a couple of those,
Yeah.
maybe more already. What unique do you hope to bring with your own work here?
Good. Yes. Okay. So it's certainly the case that there are introductions to Whitehead's thinking, right? Each generation offers a one or two. The problem is, most of the introductions to Whitehead's thinking are about as difficult as reading Whitehead himself. And that's not very helpful for people, at least a certain a certain demographic of people who are were maybe philosophically, theologically interested, inclined, wanting to get their toes wet. But if you give them Elizabeth Krauss, Metaphysics of Experience, it's not going to do much for them. So I felt the need to contribute something positive to in the introductory demographic that would include the value of what previous texts have offered, but also transcend them as well. So Jay knows this. I think Jay is brilliant at this. The work, the introductory, the language you're offering in Open Horizons is a beautiful
Yeah.
expression of that. Your short book on, what is it, Five
Right.
Questions,
It was, I
is
think it was
also great
eight.
at
It was
that.
eight, but it was really written for a
Eight.
Chinese audience.
Yes.
So, and they were
So that's why you
not,
left God out.
that's right. They were not
No.
especially interested in God. And
Sure.
so anyway,
Well,
go ahead. But
no,
the
my
question is,
point
what
is,
do you emphasize? What does an
sure.
introduction to Whitehead look like? And what needs to be emphasized and what needs to be put aside, if anything?
Sure. Well, just to close the point I was making, first, you have a beautiful, buttery way of writing. Bob Mezley has a great way of writing. His Templeton text is probably the go-to text. Slightly more complex is somebody like Tom Hosinski, but it's a great stubborn fact. Creative Advance is a great and wonderful text. So the text that I'm writing currently tries to strike a mean between those levels of communication. So it's not as if we're not going to have to think. We got to think. But so what I include, I think, is a deeper historical background first, that sort of the antecedent, ancient antecedents of process thinking. So the first part of the book is on being and becoming, and is a sort of historical snapshot of the antecedent dimensions that are brought to being in Whitehead in a certain way, but are in no way confined to him. I think the dimension on experience, right, and Whitehead's critiques of science, the orthodox science or orthodox philosophy of his time, could be expressed more. And I think the cosmological dimensions, so I include dimensions of the astral question, other worlds, extraterrestrial life, which I've been writing on independently. But let me put it this way, and this is a wonderful quote from Eva Lin, Whitehead's wife, and it's in Lucian Price's dialogue. She says, she's talking about Whitehead, his thinking is a prism. It must be seen not from one side, but from all sides. So seen, as one looks from underneath and overhead, you see it spinning with light and color. And so this prismatic metaphor for approaching Whitehead is helpful. You could see each introduction as a side of a prism. In fact, when I was learning Whitehead, I read almost every introduction that I could get my hands on. It was like I was looking at a side of a prism. But I take that metaphor in this book, and each part of the book is the side of a prism that we're looking through, but never detached from the others. So the last thing I'll say is, I'm a fan of Whitehead's God, as you both know. And I think I'm able to communicate a certain vision of it that perhaps hasn't been done before. So I'm trying to do that in a playful and a creative way, and with some humor along the way. So again, I want the text to not be an overly difficult text. So, but writing an intro is hard. It's not obvious what to leave out, what to include. We struggle with not confusing what Whitehead really says with what we want him to say, right? So here's this subjective element. All I can say is those are things I'm struggling through, but there's a romance involved, and I have an intellectual crush on Whitehead. Otherwise, I wouldn't be writing this text. So.
You didn't mention Sherburne, and I mean, I know you probably did mention Sherburne in your book. What do you make of Sherburne? He's had such an influence on people reading Process and Reality. What's your take on Sherburne's key?
The key was Sherburne's key. It was very helpful to those listening who don't know that. That's his, his essentially his reorganization of process and reality so that it'd be more readable for intro students. I mean, you are getting Whitehead in that book, so I think that's a great text. But again, I don't think it's wise to hand people process and reality per se if they're wanting to get their feet wet. I mean, at worst, that sort of could turn them away from what really could be a transformative worldview, and it was for me. And so, what I'm attempting to do is sort of communicate that transformation in palatable language. I think Sherburne does a great job in that text, but I think that's still too heavy for a lot of people. I don't really like Sherburne's Whitehead Without God stuff. Of course, he was an important part of that discussion. What was the early article? Maybe in the maybe 80s or so. I think problems arise there. So part of what I want to do in this text is show at least why Whitehead and myself find that something of the divine element is needed to make sense of some real problems or questions that arise when thinking about the emergence of experience and the wider process of the cosmos. So I have nothing major against Sherburne. I just don't think the I think overlooking or dismissing or saying we don't simply don't need what Whitehead termed God or renaming it, arguably, is not a step that I would make. But process people are friendly together. This is an open argument, you know, and I think it's important to keep the humor there.
When I read Process and Reality under John Cobb, I, like many of the other students, used Sherburne as a key to understanding an actual occasion of experience. And so Sherburne's diagrams became embedded in our minds, and
Nice.
that's what an actual occasion is. And Cobb casually noted one day a problem with his diagrams. And that is that the past actual world, understood as the universe of previous actual entities, was actually part of the concressing process, not outside it. So it's the universe that concresses in a moment of experience. And as soon as he said that, I looked back at those diagrams and I thought, well, you're right. He kind of draws a circle and has it outside the process of concrescence. So I guess the point is just how instrumental diagrams and things it can be that may mislead as well as inform.
That's a brilliant point. And one thing I am doing with this intro I'm writing is including a few attempted diagrams. You know, I'm not a big fan of diagrams, but of course, each intro to Whitehead tries to include some diagrams. So I agree. There are some great diagrams in Sherburne. The whole universe concressing, I mean, Whitehead modes of thought, the whole universe conspires to create a new occasion. The past is settled in an objective sense, but it flows into the concressing, right? So you can't actually really distinguish a concressing occasion from what the whole universe is doing. Yeah, I think that's very important. One way I like to frame it is the universe at every moment is rising up from the truth, right? The historical truth. And if we're going to jump to the consequent nature, this is God as the ground of truth, right? That the universe is literally built on truth, right? In the sense of a process universe that has achievements in the past that are indicating certain directions for the future. Jared, I see your hand.
I want to dwell a little bit on this God discourse in Whitehead studies. So you just had an article come out in the latest edition of our Process Studies journal, defending the goodness of Whitehead's God
How
against some
dare
detractors. So
I?
yeah, could you kind of set the stage? What's going on with this discourse around Whitehead's God and morality? Maybe any connections to the discourse about Whiteheadian metaphysics without God. And I'd be interested to hear you try to kind of steel man these positions. See if you can give a good argument for why they think the way they do, even as you are taking an alternative route.
Yeah, that's tough. And I was just on with Peter Sostet-Hughes, who was one of my main critical dialogue partners in that article this morning. Right. Well, it's not a new critique of Whitehead's God. So Stephen Lee Ellie, a number of years ago, I think it was a whole book on Whitehead, but he made the claim that perhaps provocatively we should not just think of a primordial and consequent nature, but a diabolical nature. Maybe we should add that
Interesting.
to Whitehead's God. Of course, he's being provocative. And I mean, of course, there is something to be said for statements Whitehead makes. He does make statements that might lend one to think that, well, this is hardly a God that is fundamentally good. There's also the problem that, well, you can't really speak of Whitehead's God without some world, right? So divine goodness, if there is such a thing, requires expression somewhere. And I think that, we can say in some sense that, well, really, the world is the context of which good is discerned, but God may not necessarily need to be good. I think my critique of Peter and Pier Francesco Basile in that article is to say that I don't think they've taken the full sweep of Whitehead's statements into account, at least in part. Right? And Peter is provocatively saying Whitehead's God is really the devil, right? It'd be an odd understanding of the devil, though, I think. So I think this is where I don't think you can just focus on the aesthetic element. So where the critique is made that Whitehead's God is really more interested in aesthetic intensity rather than moral intensity, I think you can make that case, and might have to within a process universe, but I don't think that means that Whitehead's God is not good, per se. And I do think you have to do some gymnastics a bit to overlook what I interpret to be some very clear statements that Whitehead makes on the issue. I argued with Randy Auxier in Munich a couple of years ago about this, where Whitehead talks about the necessary goodness of God in the last part of Process and Reality, and people love to overlook that. So if I were to steel man the case, it's the case that, well, aesthetics really takes precedence, and that the real qualm is how we situate the relationship between aesthetics and ethics, or beauty and goodness. And in the end, Whitehead's God is really more interested in the beautiful. And if that requires evil, which for Whitehead sometimes it does, then that really casts major doubt on the goodness of God. So I don't know if I've made the case strongly there, right? But I just think that it's important to see that if there's any goodness at all, okay, so we can frame the question larger, forget about God for a second. If there's any goodness at all, if any value is achieved, we have to find a way in which to metaphysically make sense of this. Part of the brilliance of the theological tradition is to say that values don't originate from nowhere, neither do possibilities of value, which is, Jay, what I define as an ideal, right? They require some manner of locus, partly because they're abstract in a certain sense. But what is that locus? And I think the right move, and I think Whitehead saw it too, is to say that truth, beauty, and goodness are part of the noetic content of a divine mind. That doesn't mean goodness is achieved, partly because it's never wholly up to God, right? This is the beauty of the process framework, this radical, scary creativity and freedom. God deals with the possible. The world is what actualizes. So if we're looking for evidence of goodness in the world, or the lack of goodness, right, this is not necessarily an immediate doubt on at least Whitehead's God, right? Because they come together. Yeah, Dave.
Andrew, would it be possible to say that, let's take goodness for a second, and let's define goodness as compassion, or at least that's one form of goodness, and compassion as empathic feeling of the condition of another entity and wanting the well-being of that entity on that entity's own terms.
Nice.
And so let's define compassion that way, a goodness in terms of compassion. Here's my question. Would it be fair to say that that particular value was not relevant for 97% of the history of the universe, ongoing history of the universe, and became relevant only somewhat recently, at least on our planet, and even there, with a certain kind of animal, mammals, perhaps. And so, yes, God has always been good in the sense of holding that ideal, but it took 13.7 billion years for that particular ideal actually to become relevant. Now, I'm curious,
Yeah.
what would you make of that? What would you think?
Well, I agree. So we're pointing to the evolutionary arc of values. So again, something is being achieved. But if you are to define compassion the way that you did, right, the sympathetic feeling, the feelings of another, right, in a sense, there's an element of compassion in all entities. They may not be able to feel it for for the sake of the other, as it
That's
were.
right. That's the deal.
But that element of mutual apprehension is a sort of compassion. But we might not yet say it's good. So I agree, Whitehead, says, right, there's some epoch of the formation of protons and electrons in the early universe. So I think that's a context in which we wouldn't say moral value or moral feeling has any real place. We certainly would say aesthetic feeling does, aesthetic intensity, because after all, the formation of protons and electrons are achievements of order, of harmony, and those are aesthetic values. But I think we have to keep our vision going with respect to that arc. With the increase in complexity, the increase in order becomes an increase of value, and there is a kind of dawning of moral intuition we might speak of, concomitant maybe with the dawning of a certain form of consciousness, where the purely arguably aesthetic values of feeling are transformed into a moral value of concern in and for that being. So morality, and Whitehead even says it in Religion in the Making, again, not that we have to be slaves to Whitehead, but the moral order is certain merely aspects of the aesthetic order. And I interpret that statement to mean that aesthetic, the aesthetic dimensions of experience are primal. Out of those emerge at high peaks moral values. And the analogy would be that just that consciousness emerges not from nowhere, but from more fundamental states of experience. So too, moral value emerges not from nowhere, but from more fundamental modes of aesthetic experience. So I agree with you, right? It's been a very short time, at least on our planet, that this moral sense has dawned. It's a great gift, I think, but also we're struggling to see currently, right, in our societies, what sort of detriments are also involved with
Well,
that.
Andrew, would you? This is one place where I'm uncertain, but I don't find it entirely plausible. I think it's kind of a Teilhardian idea that the universe, kind of from the get-go, has been on its way toward and aiming toward something like compassion, and thus understood, seeking the well-being of the other on the other's own terms. And so that would mean that like 90%, 97% of the history of the universe, in a way was on its way toward 3%, is probably a bit high.
Probably.
0.1%. I don't know that I find that credible. Maybe so, but how about you? How about you? Or would you say, no, not really. You needn't say it's
Well,
all preparatory to that heightened form of value. What do you think?
are you? So I don't think we don't want to interpret it anthropocentrically, right? And say that, right, what is driven for in this cosmic eros is the emergence of human value structures.
Of
We have to be
us.
careful about that. Okay, and there is a wonderful statement Whitehead makes. I think it's 290 or 291 in Adventures of Ideas, where he says, we should not rigidly codify the good. It's not as if we're going to go to another planet and other beings will have, an obvious the same expression of goodness in terms of morality. But I don't have too much of an issue with it if you really hold to the fact that there is an upward trend or drive that extends from a divine offering. It may be that truth, beauty, and goodness, which extends from God's primordial nature, is seeking those heightened values precisely in the process of creation, but that it literally takes time. Right. So it's not as if everything before it is valueless, certainly not. This is an adventure in which everything has its sort of place in terms of appreciations of value from bottom to top. There can be expressions of value far beyond the human that we can scarcely imagine. That doesn't make the phase that we've gone through axiologically less than valuable. So does that help? I mean,
No, it does.
I
Yeah,
see
it
the
does.
I see the rub though, right? It's not as if we reach goodness and we're done, right?
Well, it's also, I just don't want to dismiss the value and the beauty of what came before as saying it
Certainly
was
not.
primarily preparatory to us. I think I want to say I'm a little nervous about ranking values too easily,
Sure.
ranking degrees of value too easily.
I wouldn't say it's primary preparatory, like preparatory for us, right? We only say that in retrospect, not because we were absolutely intended, but because without that, we can't be, or at least anything like us, right? So there's a sense in which it's more of a free-flowing preparatoriness, presupposition. But it doesn't take 2 billion years bacteria reigned. You know, what's it like to be a bacterium? I'm not sure, but it's something, right? There's an element of achievement of value. So I want to hold that arc together. I'm not trying to retrospectively say, well, we have more value and it's all about us. It happened to be the case that that's required such that creatures of ourselves and our inclinations have emerged. It need not have been that way. It could have been different. Yeah. But there is a rub there. I agree.
One of the unique aspects of the process tradition, and certainly Whitehead's thought in particular, seems to be holding teleology in a really unique way. I've had a number of experiences where I've been talking with people about Whitehead who are like vaguely familiar, and they say something like, "Well, Whitehead wasn't really a teleological thinker," and I always scratch my head a little bit at that that sort of apprehension of his philosophy, because I see teleology through the whole ontology he presents. It's ubiquitous, in fact, but it is not the kind of preordained global sort of teleology that I think people are typically thinking of, and which perhaps can more rightly be associated with Teilhard, with an asterisk there, of course, for a lot of the discussion we had at the Villanova conference.
Yeah,
But
good.
yeah, I mean, this seems like one of the really kind of unique offerings of a process worldview and philosophy that, okay, we can still be negotiating and thinking along this dimension of teleology, which certainly in the postmodern turn has almost been completely rejected, completely taken out of discourse. When you're dealing with this kind of heavy-handed, like everything is going towards this predetermined goal, yeah, I think the problems that Jay is hinting at absolutely come up. Well, so much is instrumentalized. You definitely get caught in things like anthropocentrism, which is absolutely entangled with our climate crisis and all kinds of other exclusivisms and exceptionalisms that I think we probably do want to avoid. So, yeah, any thoughts from you on how teleology fits into this and how we ought to think about teleology and resources from our process traditions to do so?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. I'm all for teleology. But let me explain what I mean. So it's definitely the case that teleology for a long time has fallen on very hard times. People are allergic to the word, right? Won't even want to use it. So as Michael Levin has said in his great work, right? Here's somebody who's showing at least the return of teleology in a deep sense in biology and the biophilosophical world. He uses the language of a certain teleophobia that we have, philosophically, metaphysically, et cetera. You know, and so if teleology with respect to Whitehead means that there is a predetermined goal that history must and will meet, then certainly not. Whitehead's not an advocate of teleology in that sense. To use the musical metaphor, which Jay will appreciate, it's an improvisation rather than a pre-written score, right? But even internal to an improv, there's certain movements of purpose, right? Free-flowing movements of purpose, of achievements of value, et cetera. So when Whitehead says the teleology, uh-oh, is the term of the universe is directed towards the achievement of beauty, I think that is that can be seen in local finite scales in some way, and you could see it towards larger scales, the whole cosmos. But it need not be a settled end, right? So James Carse has written a beautiful book called Infinite and Finite Games. In fact, I'd recommend it to everybody. Beautiful meditation where he's saying some games are played to win, right? Finite games. And once you've won, once the end is met, the game stops. Other games are infinite games that you play simply for the sake of playing, right? And even Hartshorne would say that something like aesthetic value cannot be exhausted in terms of achievement. There's no nth degree of aesthetic achievement. In fact, it's one of those stubborn infinite values that is sort of inexhaustible. And I think this is what Whitehead has in mind in some sense in using that language of from a large scale, right, of the universe, the teleology of the universe. is headed towards this infinite exploration of the beautiful. But it's obvious that teleology is in his system. Right? Every aim that is there's an aim a part of every concrescent occasion. And that aim ultimately, at least for him, comes from an initial aim, right? The divine initial aim, which merges in some sense with the subjective aim. When that aim is achieved, something of value has occurred. So I'm teleology is returning at levels scientific, levels philosophical. I think Whitehead anticipated this partly in response to the Romantic poets, chapter five, Science in the Modern World. Their protest was a protest on behalf of value, right? The exclusion of value from matter of fact. And so we see a wonderful return of value in Whitehead's world. The last thing I'll say is we're an expression of it, right? Again, we don't want to be anthropocentric. We do want to be anthropocosmic. We're an expression of the cosmos and not a deviation from it. And I just will not give up on that point. Whitehead has a great line, right? Scientists animated by the purpose of proving they are purposeless constitute an interesting subject of study, right? This is a sort of playful set, a nudge to these performative contradictions that we beings, which in every moment and every day operate through purposes, aims, ideals, we're haunted by them. Those don't come from nowhere. There's antecedent dimensions of that which extend all the way down in nature for Whitehead and really are never ultimately absent. So I think teleology is still returning. We need more creative work on that. Part of the difficulty is rethinking how we use the language. It's not a William Paley type of thing, right? That we're not dealing with design arguments of teleology. It's not
Right.
divine design, it's divine desire, right? And that's different, but teleology belongs in the desiring universe as well. So does that help a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I've seen it likewise coming up in certain ways, certainly. Some of the like chaos theory, cybernetics type stuff has been talking about ideas of attractors as well. I mean, that's unique. Levin's work and others thinking, well, maybe there's some top-down causation in addition
Sure,
to this
sure.
purely kind of billiard balls deterministic
Right.
version of the story that we get so predominantly. And certainly, yeah, if something, if a more complex integrated entity is causing something amidst its parts or in other ways, there's some kind of intention or aim to that activity. And I mean, the second you start thinking about human life and our own experiences, obviously we intend to do things, and in many cases, we're able to take the intention and implement it in action in various ways in our lives. And well, obviously, there's teleology here. So, at what point does this enter the picture? Is it this miracle human phenomenon? Well, that doesn't really make sense. And now we're stuck in anthropocentrism in a different way. And so, I think the anthropocosmic rebuttal is a strong one. I think a big part of this is a certain dimension of realism that the process ontologies typically have, which I mean that's another kind of major turn we're seeing towards speculative realism and related trends. And I think here again, Whitehead very much anticipated things. I mean, to extend your jazz metaphor, well, I mean, yeah, you can play any note in an improvisation, but the specific attainment of value of that note is going to be significantly determined and colored by the presence of the other notes in the field. And I mean, a skilled jazz musician will tell you, well, yeah, there's no wrong notes, perhaps, because the improvisation continues. And such a blue note can be recontextualized in a phrase by a skillful musician to actually be evocative and not just sound bad or mistaken or out of place. And but that requires that there are real relations between between the subsequent notes temporally, but also within a field at any given time. There's these other instruments as well. Yeah, so
Well,
that's
yeah,
definitely
no.
part of this. Please.
I'll let Jay, I'll let you jump in just a sec, but Whitehead, of course, was a great lover of music, and he has, this great statement again. There's some gems in the dialogues book that Price writes. There's controversy about the book, but or it, to continue the musical dimension, but there's relations not just among actualities, right? But the actual and the possible. This distinction is very, very real for Whitehead, and he has a great statement where he imagines this composer, composing this beautiful piece of music, and then he says, "But everywhere around him hover the infinitudes of possibility, the alternative ways this vastness might be expressed." Right? So it's like the emergence of an eternal object of some wild patterned kind of some way, maybe. But right, but we're not just related to actualities, we're related to possibilities, and not just in any neutral sense. We're related to the possible through a compass of value. So I think that's important to keep in mind, because it's not as if we invent the possible in some way. We don't invent arguably a value structure that's associated with the possible. So it may not be good or bad notes, but there's harmony and discord, right? Again, these are not trivial. We don't invent those concepts. So I just think to see ourselves as an expression of them, use prismatic metaphor, because we're attempting to see the universe philosophically, metaphysically, from all its different sides at once, and not forget that we have to do that. But it's rather hard to do. Last thing on the teleology bit, people don't like teleology for a number of reasons, but there's a theological bias, of course, right? If there's purpose in nature, in some sense, does that mean there's a larger purpose behind it? And we're facing the meaning crisis, as you know. There's people are dragged into nihilism in different ways, and sometimes they like it, right? I don't really like the nihilistic perspective, and I think there's good reasons to reject it. And I just think that relocating value in nature is a helpful remedy to that, and seeing ourself as an expression of that value is also a helpful remedy to that. We start with experience, you know. Sorry, Jay, I was laboring on, but I think you wanted to jump in.
Well, I did want to jump in about teleology. As I read Whitehead, not that Whitehead is God or, everything Whitehead says is right, but
Sure.
it seems to me that in Process and Reality, the telos of every single concressing subject is satisfaction. Every concressing subject is aiming at satisfaction in the moment, in the subjective immediacy, that's his phrase, of the moment. And in Process and Reality, he says it's the intensity that the concressing subject is aiming at. So intense satisfaction, which is enhanced by harmony. But his primary word is intensity. That seems to me, Andrew, to be a different kind of teleology than, say, to talk about ideals, which might inspire or which might lead us to explore or move us into the future or take us onto a journey. So it's led me to distinguish, I think, in conversation with you, a distinction between the value of ideals and the existential value of immediate experience, on its own terms for its own sake. And on the existential value of immediate experience, I don't think it's quite right to call it an achievement. Or you can, but something's missed. The subjective immediacy of it, the joy, and actually that's another word to use this, the enjoyment of satisfaction. So on to music. Tonight I'll be playing
Yeah.
music at a local restaurant, and we will play Proud Mary by Creedence Clearwater.
Right.
And we'll get into it. And we won't be aiming toward the end. The joy is in
Yes.
the music itself. And I think if somebody came up and stopped us at a moment and said, Are you having an achievement? I think we'd say, I think you're missing something. It's the process of enjoyment itself that is where the value is. And so that's kind of a question. Would you ha be happy with two kinds of value, the value of ideals and the existential immediacy of satisfaction? And granted, satisfaction is realizing ideals. I know that. And actualizing possibilities, I know that. But there seems to be a difference. Any thoughts on that for you?
Well, I think that's really beautifully put. Yeah, I wouldn't want to draw a big wedge between those because I think in part what a satisfaction is the culmination of a felt ideal given the context, right? So, but it's certainly the case that, like, I like your right, this moment is ultimate too, right? So I think when you're emphasizing the primacy of this moment as being ultimate, I think you're pointing to in part what you've said there. And I absolutely agree that purpose teleology, if we're going to use it in Whitehead's universe, is internal to the process. And it's an infinite game and not a finite game. When we say our lives have purpose, we're not saying, we're not using an end state to frame that. It's like saying the purpose of your life is your corpse, right? So the purpose is not something you achieve at the end. It's something that is achieved in and through the process. So if someone interrupted your musical song tonight, that would be sort of unfortunate. But even the whole song is an event, right? And there's events within the events, in a sense. And at every phase, there's anticipations and felt valuations. Each playing of a note could be seen as a sort of satisfaction. So we could extend the metaphor. I just think you can hold those two together. And see it from local finite dimensions of the universe, and then from a larger, sort of,
It's
if you want, infinite
Andrew, it's the
perspective.
Zen Buddhist in me that wants not to forget the primacy of the moment. So there's actually a
Absolutely.
religious dimension to that for me. It's this moment is absolute too. It's that emphasis. But I agree with you. You needn't put a wedge there, but it's to preserve the ultimacy of the present moment that leads to that question.
And I think just existentially, practically, because I think Whiteheadians want to practice this too, it's a good reminder that purpose is sought in the momentary, through each tender movement. It's like those things would slowly and tenderly operate by love, right? To quote Whitehead, but it's not. Sometimes I don't think we see ourselves living purposely until we have certain achievements in the future, right? But there's whole antecedent, dimensions that allow that achievement to come into being. So the achievement of the song is not necessarily its ending, right? But one wouldn't know that the song had achieved something without that ending too. So right, there's phases of events. It's a satisfaction of the musical event,
And you remember that passage in part five of Process and Reality on God, where he talks about the Galilean vision.
Love
And
it.
I would call it up, but I can't right now. But it's something to the effect of finds its purpose in the immediacy of the moment, and then adds that mysterious phrase, and it's not of this world. He says both of those things. Do you remember
How
that
did you say?
passage?
Well, I certainly do. Yeah, it's finds its purpose. I
I
forget the
think
exact
Jared's
phrasing.
pulling it up. Are you pulling it up, Jared? Oh,
Oh.
okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure where
In
that
the
one
present
is.
immediacy of a something that is not of this world.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, maybe, yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's like
Oh, but
you
not
can almost
concerned
think
for the
of.
future. Not concerned for the future. I'll call it up. You keep talking, I'll call it up. Go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking, well, if we could throw in the kingdom of God language in some sense, right? Which is it's not of this world. And yet its realization happens in the world, but I see what you're saying. And I love how you want to be not overlooking these present moment dimensions. So I agree with you. I just think we're looking at different dimensions of it.
Well, I'm about to get that passage, in which case we'll
Yeah,
know.
what?
Let's see.
It's the love passage. Love neither rules nor is it unmoved. It's also a little oblivious to morals. It finds its purpose in the present immediacy and doesn't.
That's it.
That one I certainly think of in the context of some of these God discourses. Is Whitehead's God good? Well, if it's a God of
Well,
love, but
good.
oblivious to morals, well, it's
Sure.
complicated.
Yes,
Let me read one. Let me read one more
okay.
sentence there. It does not look to the future, for finds its own reward in the immediate present. That's the last sentence of that paragraph.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful way of this moment is ultimate too, right? So
Yeah.
I think we can read that. But yeah, Jared, in the article that just came out in Process Studies, that's one of the, at least Basel, one of the authors I'm sort of arguing against, cites that, right? God's a little oblivious to morals. Well, does that mean God doesn't care? Well, the context of the whole passage, and I think it, in the larger context of Whitehead's work, is his critique of a rigid codification of morality, right? A static form of morality in a fluid and processual universe. And saying, the purest conservative is fighting against the essence of the universe is right. It's sort of critique to say in the moral frame that we're holding on to a codified dimension of morality that's irrelevant to where things are headed or what's the way in which the moments of time have passed through that. So I don't think it's a statement that God is oblivious. I think the larger dimension of Whitehead's work would show that to be otherwise. But it's linked to that rigid codification of morality. And it's uttered in terms of of a statement of love in the Galilean vision. That's hardly an oblivious kind of statement. Anyway.
Another kind of theological connection I've been thinking about in this discourse is, well, we said that a process perspective doesn't have this kind of global teleological vision. It seems like a lot of traditional religious ideas hinge on that, though. The kingdom of God, certainly, that we hear about in the New Testament and is central to Jesus's sayings. Well, a lot of the interpretation of that has been in this kind of teleological frame, and certainly eschatology, even more so. Well, there's some kind of culmination or final end towards which this creation, cosmos, and the human's place in it is pointing. How do you reconcile these things?
Well, I think you can have finalities of great finalities of achieved value, but they need not end the process. So I think to the extent that eschatology has been understood to be after which everything has ended and the
The
process has
closing of
stopped,
the book
it,
at the
it's
back
not a
cover.
it, yeah it's not a closing, because even you could say that, I mean, what else is a afterlife than a continuation of the adventure of existence, albeit in a different ontological frame? Process thinkers balance that tension. There's been great work done on process eschatology, World Without End, which is Joe Bracken's edited volume, which is a series of authors which engages Souhaki's good work in her book The End of Evil, which was putting forth a subjective form of immortality. But I think there is sort of there is real endings. There's real beginnings, certainly, but I don't think eschatology requires us to say that these are capitalized big E or big B in nature. There needs to be a good eschatology worked out. Whitehead has an eschatology. It's right there in part five. It's even there in Adventures of Ideas. The final union of zest with youth and peace. It's just beautiful culmination, but it doesn't end the process, right? It may be an ending of a certain kind, right? One epoch might feed into another. Epochs end, cosmological epochs, for all we know. That's an eschaton of a certain type. But it may be that the divine vision need not have any final collapse in terms of the process. Why would there be? I mean, anyhow. But you're right. There's a tension here with religious visions that want to be hold a deep confidence in an eschatological culmination. And process thinkers have often wanted to say, well, there's no guarantee. I think we can be confident that the divine powers, which without which would a world would not have been this kind. Can be trusted in a sense and collaborated with into futures that we can't really unfathom. And that may be all we can ask for at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, in some senses, I could see a more traditional theist complaining that, oh, this process vision, it's a lot more wishy-washy, it's a lot less certain. But at the same time, I feel like we can think eschatology in more open ways and in more kind of stacked throughout ontology and temporality rather than merely as one singular final endpoint. I mean, in some senses, the perpetual perishing of all occasions could be eschatologically read. And then, I mean, seeing this kind of as a basic ontological feature rather than merely some culmination of the cosmos writ large or human destiny. I don't know. I find that a little more compelling in some ways. And there's a certain naturalism that can then come in once something like that is connected at a more basic level of the ontology rather than merely posited as some kind of far
Sure.
off cosmological vision.
And we should remember, too, process and reality is analysis of perishing, right? Whitehead was bugged by the real transitoriness of things, right? There's a eschatology is going on all the time in some deep sense. And I think process thinkers want to extend that out and say, well, it's an imminent eschatology and not necessarily transcendent eschatology. And even on traditional Orthodox understandings, like it's not really an eschatology as I mean, it's the end of a certain creative creation of, in some way, but it's not as if that's the total end, right? Afterlife is a continuation in some way. And so there's eschatological stages, I think, for Whitehead that are happening all over the universe. You could think that you could read it naturally in terms of evolution too. It's like there's stages of, from Big Bang to emergence of life, emergence of mind, all these are endings and beginnings. And I don't see why we can't read something like that happening on a far, very large universal scale, the ending of a cosmic epoch, the birth of another, right? Crucio continua.
If you think of the consequent nature of God as the ongoing concrescence of the universe, which it is, then in fact the eschaton is occurring all the time. It's
Yeah,
like
realized us.
we're swimming in an ocean of something that receives and integrates everything that happens into whatever beauty is possible. So it's continuous and ongoing, but it is also here now. And Hartshorne had such a deep sense of that, of that lives contribute to something more than they are all the time. All the time. Not just at the end of their lives. And so for him, for him, the notion of personal life after death was not important. It was for Marjorie Supaki, and it is for me, it is for others. But you've got eschatology even without personal life after death, and it's the consequent nature of God. And for Hartshorne and people like that, it's continuous.
Sure. So it will never not be the case that Hartshorne's life doesn't continue to influence.
Right.
Right? So it's the object of immortality. So you're
And is remembered and somehow preserved in whatever goodness it realized. Everlasting.
Definitely. I mean, I certainly understand that at the very least, everything is objectively immortal in the consequent nature of God in some deep way.
Right.
The question Griffin and others have raised is, well, is that enough, really? Right, so you can sort of use the argument from evil in that context and say, well, it's not quite enough. Suhaki sort of put it that way too. Hartshorne's objection was, right, to immortality as a career after death, like literally an infinite sort of,
Yeah.
So I think he told Griffin that if it need not necessarily be everlasting, well, maybe I'd be more open to that, right? And I don't think he objected to anything in principle in process Whitehead's thinking to make that
No,
possible.
and he doesn't have the final word, but I do think he thought that the
Certainly not.
preoccupation was a bit selfish. He thought that.
Sure. It
I'm
can
on
be
the other
understood that
side.
way.
I'm on the other side, but I think there's some wisdom in his perspective there.
The way he
Also.
put it is we have to finally come to terms with God being more important than we are, right? And
Yeah,
I like that. There's something deeply right about that. My critique, though, is that I think he's being too unimaginative for the process universe, right? Where Whitehead really says, although it's neutral, the system is neutral on life after death and spiritual beings, there's no reason the question couldn't be satisfied on other evidence, provided it's trustworthy. So that's the thing, right? There's the opening to NDE experience, et cetera. Like, is the evidence trustworthy? And then even in Adventures of Ideas, he says, you know, he could imagine a context in which, right, that the intimacy, the mutual imminence of occasions between God and the world is so intimate that there might be a possibility of freeing ourselves from our body in a sort of post-mortem state. Who knows what that would be like? You know, so
That's
that's why I
amazing.
say Hartshorne may not have been, you know, as imaginative, I hope. But he's got a point, of course. Yeah, there's terrible ways to envision immortality, boring ways, static ways, and then there's ways in which the adventure doesn't end. There's infinite exploration of worlds upon worlds rolling over, right?
Well, I
So,
hear Roland Farber
well, that's I think it's Coleridge or Shelley,
in there.
but that would be my approach.
Hey, Andrew, look, can we turn to astrobiology just for a moment? I have a question here. I know that some people are interested in the question of whether there's life in other dimensions or on other planets and the like. It seems to me it depends on partly on what you mean by life, but if by life you mean something like, and I'll use some Whiteheadian phrases, self-enjoyment, self-creativity, decision, emotion, subjective form, feeling, prehension.
I see where you're going here.
There is so much life beyond this planet, and it doesn't need to be biological life as we understand it to be living. As a matter of fact, it's also an empty space, which is actually not a vacuum, but a plethora of momentary pulsations of experience, each of which have those properties. So, help me out here. Help me out here to sort through this question of life beyond Earth or whatever.
Wonderful. Yeah, I totally agree. And what you've nicely expressed there is Whitehead's living ontology. So I'm proofing a chapter right now called Whitehead's Living Ontology for a Space and Philosophy volume. But that's partly what I argue. Related to this is also mind, right? And there's so Evan Thompson, a number of others are writing interesting articles, books, updates on this relationship between life and mind. So process thinkers are willing to say mind goes all the way down. In part, that's what pan-experientialism means. I argue that we should also, in some sense, say life goes all the way down. In fact, I think life and mind are sort of inherently wedded together. Certainly, the language you've used of self-enjoyment, of emotion, feeling, these are dimensions that are not absent from the far side of Whitehead's ontology. So whatever actual occasions are and whatever they're doing, it's not death and they're not dead, right? So, and Teilhard struggled with this too. He says, you know, prior to life, there's not death, there's pre-life in some sense. But whatever it is, it's not lifeless, right? And if it was, right, we face the deep challenge, kind of like with materialism, saying mind from vacuous matter, how do we get life from lifelessness? So I think astrobiologically speaking, or in the philosophy of astrobiology, it would be fun to develop, as I'm trying to do, the discourse of living ontology. And I think Whitehead affirms that. I think he says it explicitly in Modes of Thought. If you read him carefully when he's talking about life, he says the absolute self-enjoyment, which is an occasion, is how I understand life. And so he's making a direct connection to life being in his ontology. And that would make sense in a universe that produced living beings, such as us, right? If death is the foundation, this is quite hard to get life out of it. Hans Jonas knew this too, right? Modern thought inverted the ontology of life for an ontology of death. And now it made life a problem instead of seeing life as an expression of deeper antecedent living dimensions. Does that help a little bit? I mean,
Right.
it's such a
I'm on
rich, it's a
board.
rich discussion.
And I really I like your phrase living ontology. I mean, I hope you run with it, and I know you will, and maybe you already have, but to my mind, that captures poetically a feeling for for the living cosmos, to which Whitehead points, and you point.
Definitely. And again, if can you have life without mind? Mind without life? I'm not sure. Pan-experientialists haven't, and panpsychists have not really settled the issue, but its bearing on exo-philosophy is quite important.
If wherever there's life, there is a feeling of ideals to be realized, it seems to me there's something like mind. I mean, it
Yes.
seems to me that mind, that's kind of what mind has to do with the prehension of possibility, I
And
think.
what that means for the process universe is absolutely there's life beyond Earth. If it's an ontology, it pervades the cosmos, right? And you're wondering about the higher achievements of that in beings like us and other beings, et cetera. So, yeah, that discussion is really energetic. It's just getting going in terms of the process world. I'm happy to have contributed to that. I know you're doing some good work too, but our tradition. Lewis Ford in 1968, his early article was so good. I mean, it's still good. I mean, there's some problems with it, but yeah, this is an underdeveloped dimension of our potential relevance, and it's just fun to think about. That's why I'm pursuing it.
Well, it's kind of liberating too, yeah. Jared,
Yes,
you
it
jump
is.
in here. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I've always been fascinated and really drawn to astronomy. One of the things I like so much about that science, that area, is it's probably the most useless of our sciences. Like, I mean, biology connects to medical research, chemistry, similarly. Astronomy, to such a significant degree, is pure sort of yearning for knowledge of our broader cosmos. And there's something very beautiful about that. Yeah, I don't know. In terms of the process stuff, it makes so much more sense of how we go from matter to organic molecules to simple life forms to more complex life forms. It gives a much more comprehensible account of that story than a lot of the philosophies that are typically brought to bear on these sorts of questions, where at some point, whoops, there's experiencing and deciding entities, and well, where'd that come from?
Well,
hard
I
to
think
say.
it is, but you said something really important there, though. You said, there's something beautiful about that, right? In the context of astronomy. So I've been thinking a lot about recently. I have a whole proposal that's getting ready to submit for another opportunity, but won't go into it too much. But beauty in the space age, right? How our orientation towards the beautiful, which has always been with us, it's been linked to our planet, has been confirmed and exponentially expanded with the advent of the space age, right? The Apollo mission, looking back, seeing Earth for the first time. Seeing its fragile beauty, right? These astronauts, this experience of almost a kind of mystical state of seeing the world for what it is and saying, this is nothing short of beautiful. It's a form of cosmological aesthetics that we've always known about, but that the space age technology has advanced and exponentially expanded our awareness of what Hubble could see, James Webb could see in more detail. And look at the James Webb photos. These are not hideous photos, right? We're seeing that beauty value actually goes beyond Earth as well, right? And so I think this is important to keep in mind. The universe is beautiful. It beyond us, it within us, and it pushes us towards a certain ethic of beauty on planet Earth, right? That the Earth is worth fighting for, preserving because of its great aesthetic integrity. So yeah, it's beautiful, right? That could not have been the case. Like, what is going on? Again, we're back to this sort of almost teleological sort of sense. Would it have been beautiful if we weren't looking at it through our telescopes? I don't see why not, right? It would be anthropocentric to say, well, things are only beautiful when I if it's recognized.
Yeah, if I could rephrase, it's not that astronomy is useless, but it is not valuable for its instrumental value primarily. There is intrinsic
Utility, yeah.
value to the knowledge of our cosmos and the experiences of beauty achieved through engaging and studying. this field, certainly.
Yeah.
I think, except
Absolutely.
for maritime societies, for seafaring societies, the stars played a tremendously important instrumental role in navigation. And so there, astronomy and practical ends very much coalesced. But I agree with you, Jared and Andrew, about the beauty. I'm wondering to both of you, you know, the varieties of beauty, and one form is the sublime, the sense of being small in the presence of something much more than you, like a thunderstorm. I mean, Kant was interested in the sublime. And I'm wondering what forms of beauty are evoked by astronomy, by a sense of the stars and the galaxies and the black holes and the supernovae. The sublime at the very least, but I just suspect there's some more as well.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And I do have a volume titled Value Beyond Earth, Explorations in Exoaxiology, which is pending response from Oxford. So my fingers are crossed. But in part, it's sort of looking at that question. One of the authors, a feminist philosopher of science, is weighing in on the space ethics debate, right? Or astro ethics, astro policy. There's all these different terms. And one of the arguments she uses is the aesthetic integrity of Mars, right? So that we have to keep this in mind when we think of colonizing, when we think of if we encounter microbes, you know, so that there's a certain, at least at the very least, a bare fact of aesthetic integrity. After all, even the circular shape, for goodness sake, right? This is a certain harmony. So I think that's a part of it. I'm not sure how that would relate to the sublime per se, but it's related in some sense. Jared.
Yeah, I think there's, at least what I've noticed in my own experience, is there's maybe something of a paradoxical phenomenology to experiences of the vastness and beauty of the cosmos, or perhaps a sort of double exposure of experience. On the one hand, you feel very small. You are realizing your tiny parochial place in this truly vast and complex web of existence. But at the same time, that can often reinforce the sense of realness and like, wow, even in such a incomprehensibly large field of existence, nonetheless, I'm here. I'm a
A little
part of
lower than the
this.
angels, right?
Yes, yeah. And so you also get the sense of significance and deep connection and resonance. And it's fascinating to me that those kind of happen often at the same time, or at least in close connection, because in some senses it's almost an opposite experience. The nihilism of, whoa, I'm tiny, versus the kind of affirmation, the deep spiritual affirmation of, ooh, I am in this phenomenal, truly incomprehensible existence. I am, and I don't know, something matters to that for sure.
You know, it may
That
also be
well.
connected to the experience of the holy, as Rudolf Otto
Mysterium
depicted
tremendum, yeah.
Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans. And so it's both frightening and fascinating, both a little scary and something you're really drawn to at the same time. And I wonder if the experience of the holy isn't arriving in our lives these days, actually, not only with help from the sky and the stars and the like, but with the instruments now. The James Webb Telescope that enhances our capacity to feel that. It's like a Bible, except it's a telescope.
Beautiful. I think I hear another Open Horizons article coming. Well, I wanted to come back to what you said, Jared, because I think it's so important to push back at the so-called Copernican principle. If by that we mean we have been decentered in terms of our meaning, or our significance. It, like, there's the whole discourse tends to focus far too much on size and meaning, size and significance. But it's not the size that counts, right? To be sort of somewhat playful. Obviously, we're not physically the center of the universe, right? But to then to take that and then say, therefore, we're meaninglessness or not insignificant, non-significant, is, I think, a step too far. What it neglects is the anthropocosmic dimension, right? It would be anthropocentric to say we are the center, and if we've been decentered, therefore, oh gosh, we can't think of ourselves as meaningful. But the anthropocosmic thing is to say, yes, although we've been cosmologically decentered, we have no other choice than to see ourselves as metaphysically recentered in terms of experience. We have to start with our experience as an expression of this cosmos. And I love Whitehead for never really giving up on that, you know? So yeah, we're small, but we matter. Even Whitehead says that the first glimmerings of consciousness are a proclamation, something matters, right? Here is something that matters. That's what consciousness says, the mattering of things, right? Not just the matter of things. So I think that's important. Copernican principle can be overstressed and in a nihilist direction. There's no real need for that. You know, so that's been part of my debates with Stephen Dick and with others in the astro conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. As I understand it, one of the insights of the kind of relativistic perspective that has come out of the more recent ventures in physics, at least past 100 years, and so is, well, center isn't some kind of final objective place to be identified. It's relative to where you're measuring, where you're experiencing. And so to say that we are not the center is as scientifically incorrect, so far as I understand it, as to
Sure.
assert that we are the center. One thing that came up relatedly for me in our kind of more phenomenological discussion was in relation to the holy. Another term I thought of is ecstasy, and the kind of etymological meaning of this term is standing outside. And in the space age, we have literally experientially come to be able to do that collectively. These astronauts standing
Yeah.
outside of Earth itself, this cosmic ecstasis of our civilization. So there's something profound there as well,
Absolutely.
and it makes good sense that this would be connected to deep spiritual experiences, as we're
Yeah.
seeing some of the same relationships of standing outside oneself, but on a literal, physical, cosmological way, standing outside of the
Yeah.
Earth, our home.
It's called the overview effect, right? Which is the of these astronauts having this ecstasis, this almost mystical experience of confronting the magnitude or the minuscule nature of Earth, but never without realizing its fragility and its beauty. So I think there's such a thing as cosmological beauty and cosmological aesthetics. The advance of science and technology has revealed this to us in a way that was not possible. Arguably to our ancestors. And I think part of the proposal I mentioned is to make that more front and center and to draw out some of the implications for how we think about our relationship to Earth and to life beyond Earth. So.
Well, we're coming to a close here, but I think we will definitely need to have some subsequent conversations to dig in further. But
Absolutely.
as a wrap-up question here, I'd love to be curious to hear your thoughts as someone immersed in these discourses and this community. Where are some of the leading edges of the process movement? And also, to a little more of a interesting, intense question. What do you think the process people have been underemphasizing or even getting wrong? Where do we need to maybe correct course a bit here?
Yeah, that's a great two-pronged question. So I'd say some of the more exciting directions. I mean, I think this whole astrobiology connection is an exciting direction, which hasn't really been, you know, pursued previously. So I think we should still pursue that. And I'm trying to put my hat in the ring and call other process thinkers to do the same. And in part, Roland Faber and I has the large astrophilosophy volume. That's a nice contribution to it, although it may take your life savings. unfortunately. So the Astro, certainly, there's the more localized terrestrial biophilosophy direction that I think is really quite interesting. Michael Levin, we mentioned, but Spyridon, Matt Siegel, and colleagues are going to have an online biophilosophy conference, I think, next July. But there's been recent work done there, which is, again, so fascinating because it's bringing back not just the teleology, but how we think about what it means to be a living organism. And so those two directions are sort of beyond Earth and localized to Earth. There's also the continual energy surrounding the relevance of psychedelics. So I was on a call with Peter and others, Sasha Hughes, who's one of the most important psychedelic philosophers in the world. And I think that is an important direction. And all of these are linked to, of course, the philosophy of mind, which is not going away. Mind at large, as it's been put, Huxley put it in that term, the status of mind at large, or mind first ontology. There's all sorts of new panpsychist, idealistic, or some combination frameworks that are out there, and that's one direction where we need to continually be in dialogue with people. So there's a few. I think where process thinkers need to take the classical tradition more seriously, from my perspective. Right, so I don't want to belabor the point, but I just think there's much the Eastern Orthodox dimensions, the mystical dimensions of that tradition should be really interesting dialogical partners. Even Aquinas and others, I think the risk is that we straw man certain dimensions of the classical theological tradition and potentially the philosophical tradition too. I think those process thinkers who are trained classically first and then find their way into process are more robust and rounded because they can speak to those connections in ways that I think some have too easily dismissed. Like the whole notion of substance, right? It's so whatever Aristotle was saying about substance, it wasn't Descartes' notion, right, of a nothing but sort of entity, right, requiring nothing but itself in order to exist. It was much more dynamic in nature. And so I just think we have to be careful about generalizing, and I mean, it's not as if we're coming up with all the good stuff now. There's antecedents, and I think we need to take that more seriously. Anyway, that's a couple things.
I would wholeheartedly agree. And I think that's a big part of what can make the process tradition more compelling to people as well nowadays,
Yeah.
especially in the internet discourse age where yeah, there's a lot of buzz about different philosophical ideas, different circles. And I think presenting too much as kind of a new kid on the block rather than connecting to historical traditions, giving a kind of robust narrative of yeah, the emergence of process thinking in different ways in different eras and different geographic locales. Yeah, that's compelling. This, I mean, I think certainly many an insight were had prior to our friend Whitehead.
Sure.
And yeah, a big part of the chat we had with Matt Segal was talking about, yeah, how do we broaden out who gets in this tent of process thinker? And yeah, sketching a new, more cosmopolitan and expansive narrative there seems very
Yeah.
worthwhile. So,
And of course, the critique can be inverted too. Those classical scholars, I think, who are too quickly dismissing the insights of
absolutely.
process metaphysics
Yeah.
should hold back a bit. I mean, we're connected to the ancient Heraclitian notion as well. It's like there's something in this that metaphysics hasn't quite settled, and we land in different places, but there's deep value on both sides, as it were. Sorry, Jay.
Well, I'm just struck with how Whitehead had a classical education, and so he was familiar with Tennyson and Keats and Shelley and Wordsworth, of course, and particularly in Science in the Modern World, but also in Process and Reality, would allude to them. And so his mind was shaped by literature as sometimes I wish his mind had been a bit more shaped by classical philosophy. I think the distortion of the concept of substance comes in part from Whitehead's own rhetoric there. But nonetheless, he was literate in a kind of almost Victorian way. But that included a knowledge of poetry, of literature, and a willingness to bring that into the discussion. And I kind of hope for that myself. I don't know if you do, a widening of horizons.
Yeah.
into the arts, into literature?
Sure.
On our part, on our part. I think he was there. Andrew, do you think he had, did he have much to say about music? You said that a little earlier. You want to say anything more about that?
I think he did have a good amount to say on music, but it's, as with a lot of things, it's hidden in the corpus, right? You have to sort of read through again and with your highlighter. But I guess the last thing I would say is just, to play off the improvisational metaphor again, I do think this is a great way of feeling your way into Whitehead's universe, you know, and that greatness is being achieved, but the direction is not obvious, right? But man, you're sure glad you were doing it, you know. So I think music is a good metaphor for it, and God is in the improvisational nature of that as well, right? Not even God knows, perhaps, what will be achieved, except in the mode of a ray of possibilities. So maybe that's a good place to end. Let's
All right.
the musical dimension of Whitehead's universe. So
Wonderful.
enjoy the concert tonight, Jake.
Onward into the melody. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Yeah,
We
thanks,
really
Andrew.
appreciate all the work that you do and what you're offering to this larger movement in such a substantial way. So,
Well,
a
I
huge
appreciate it,
thanks.
and I'm building off other shoulders, yours included, Jay and Jared. Yours is you're just up ahead. I'm quite confident of that. You're the
I'm trying to catch
future.
up with Jared.
Yeah,
I'm flattered.
thank you guys though. Have a good rest of the day.
All
All
right, you
right.
too.